On the show today, I was joined by the Kabul crew, the beautiful workers and employees of the Kabul Medical Service up at Toowoomba. We talked a lot about the differences between non-AMSs and AMSs. We talked about the programs that they offer for their community. And we listened to the lovely Dr. Adrian talk about why he loves working in an AMS and how you can get on board. So have a listen and enjoy the fun and frivolity with the Kabul crew.
Indigenous Health Med Talks with Dr. Danielle Arabina, yarning with innovators, trailblazers and community leaders in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health and medicine. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are advised that this podcast may contain the voices of persons now deceased. We would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians, Yuggera and Turrbal people, from where Dr. Danielle is broadcasting, and extend our acknowledgement to the elders past and present of all our listeners.
Hello there, it's Dr. Danielle Arabina here, and we are here with the podcast for Indigenous Health Med Talk. And I'm here with the lovely Kabul crew today up at the beautiful Toowoomba. It's a nice brisk day, which is pleasant. So I'm just going to introduce the crew. So starting on my left.
Hello, my name is Charlie Rowe. I'm the Community Outreach Manager for Kabul Medical Services. I'm a proud Kamilaroi man from a little mission called Toomala.
Hi everyone, my name is Dr. Adrian Castelli and I'm one of the GPs at Kabul.
Hi there, my name is Tamika Campbell. I'm the Clinic Manager of Kabul Medical Services and I am also a proud Mandandandji woman from the Maranoa region.
Hi, my name is Amy Arabina Burns and I am an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health worker at Kabul Medical Services. I'm a proud Miriam woman from Murray Islands and the Torres Straits.
Hi everyone, I'm Brian Hewitt and I'm the CEO of Kabul.
Well, I'm so excited to have Kabul with us today. Kabul will often come with us when we have our cultural immersions up at Bunya Mountains, and our registrars just love them so much. So first of all, I'd like to hit with the hard-hitting questions about why do AMSs even exist?
Well, that's a good question, Daniel, because if you're going to look at Aboriginal health, we need to understand why we do exist. And Aboriginal medical services grew from an initiative that started back in Redfern in the 70s where people realised that the two main determinants of the gap that exists between Aboriginal, the health of Aboriginal people and non-Aboriginal people really comes down to two factors. The main factor was access to services. And despite the fact that people think, well, that's a remote issue, most of our Aboriginal people live in metropolitan or regional areas, so there's access there. What wasn't there was a feeling within the communities that the access to those health services was culturally safe or aware of the various nuances that affect Aboriginal health. So the Redfern Initiative decided that the best way to address Aboriginal health issues was by putting Aboriginal people in the front line of those health services and provision. And because of the success of that initiative, the AMS, or the Aboriginal Medical Service Initiative, grew, and there are now several hundred of them across Australia, where predominantly Aboriginal health workers and other people are in the front line of the provision of those services.
Perfect. So it is so important to have, I think, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander faces in the health centres where people come into. I think it really helps welcome people but also makes them feel very comfortable. You talked a bit, Brian, about the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health worker. Can you tell us a bit about the role that they play in Kabul, and maybe we can get a couple of our other panel members to join in?
Well, they're the key element and probably the key difference between an Aboriginal medical service and other medical services, as well-intentioned as they can be. Aboriginal culture doesn't rely on a written or learned education. So it's an experienced understanding of that culture and where people come from. So Aboriginal people know that when they walk into a medical service and the faces that they see are Aboriginal faces, that those people have that lived experience, that lived education of the factors that will determine how well or otherwise they're going to access those services. So the portal between the community and the professional, the other professionals, the nurses and the doctors, is the Aboriginal health worker. There are less than 200 Aboriginal doctors across Australia. So most AMSs employ doctors that aren't Aboriginal in the first instance. You know, there are Aboriginal doctors working for AMSs, but they're light on the ground at the moment. So when we can have an Aboriginal health worker who can identify with the community members what their health requirements are, help them to communicate that with the doctor, help in that follow-up process, it's crucial to how far that process will go in addressing those needs. So they really are, for me, they are the key difference and critical to the success of Aboriginal medical services.
Also, following up with what Brian said, Danielle, is it's critical on the other side for the GPs to be able to work and rely on the Aboriginal health worker, because if we employ Aboriginal health worker and Torres Strait Islander health workers from that community they're actually working in, we actually know our mob, where they are. With our clients, a lot of them change their numbers or they, you know, change their addresses on a regular basis. So having an Aboriginal health worker come from that community also helps the GPs if there's emergency recalls or they need to get them back in again. So it works both ways, like Brian said, yes.
I think that's a great point, Charlie, because in my practice I pride myself in being able to create a relationship with my clients where they feel comfortable and not judged and they can disclose anything to me. But there is always that little bit of information that I can't get myself, and that's when Amy or any of the other health workers at Carbel can come to me and say, hey, did you know this about that patient? And it will be just that little keystone that I need to get my job done. So to me, that's just another way, another reason why the health worker is so important to us.
Perfect. While we're talking about health workers, I'm really curious about what sort of training, like how does one become an Aboriginal health worker?
Well, to become an Aboriginal health worker.
Or Torres Strait Islander health worker.
And Torres Strait Islander health worker. I did a course that I was very lucky enough that Carbel assisted me in doing that. I was a medical receptionist at Carbel for nearly a year, and then I decided that I would like to be more hands-on and take a clinical role and, you know, have that connection with my community, not just on an admin level but on a medical level as well. And that we were talking about before when Dr. Castelli mentioned having that rapport with our clients is so important. So I decided then everyone agreed I would go to TAFE, and it's usually, I think, a two-year course around about then. And, you know, I finished it in a shorter period of time because I was so passionate about it. But it's something that I believe being at an AMS and going through that study, if I wasn't working at Carbel, it would have taken me a long time because I was supported. I was supported from the CEO, my manager. I had questions for doctors. I had questions for health workers, nurses, everybody. So I feel like it was a community effort to get me across the line, and now it's a community effort for us to work together.
So it's wonderful that you're able to be supported by your work to be able to give back to the community.
The reason that we do support the training of our Aboriginal health workers, Danielle, is because, again, there just are not enough trained Aboriginal health workers around. So under the Closing the Gap initiative, I think if there was more provision of courses that are available, because it's very difficult to find courses because Aboriginal people don't have the time and the finances to access them, so it's demand-driven. If the government had an initiative where they could assist Aboriginal people to get that level of training, you would see a bigger difference in the Closing the Gap initiative than any of the other initiatives combined have been to date. If we can get more Aboriginal people involved in this process of providing health services, it will make a huge and almost overnight difference to the provision of health.
I'm curious around the role of the Aboriginal health worker and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health worker, besides, you know, providing that sort of intimate knowledge of the community, like, do you do any clinical work or, you know, are you like a registered nurse or not?
Well, I've been very lucky at Kabul to have a community approach and a clinical approach. So I've been fortunate enough to work in the treatment room alongside of nurses doing things, you know, spirometries, ECGs, wound cares, a lot of HbA1cs and urine ACRs, things like that. So it's not just the community, it's a lot of it is clinical as well. But it depends, I guess, where you work and what your role is in that AMS. It could be a community-based Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health worker, or it could be a clinical one.
Also, following on what Amy said, Danielle, is you, with our 715s probably, or even just a normal consult for our clients, when they arrive at our clinic, we actually, they go and see the reception, then they sit down and wait for the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health worker to come and call them into the room or consult room. And the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health workers actually do their OBS, so, you know, their blood pressures, their sugars if need be, the temperatures, and put all that data into our best practice. And so that just alleviates a bit of the time for the doctor to be doing that stuff, where the doctor can have more time to be yarning up and all that sort of stuff too.
And just not to mention there, Charlie, the allied health referrals that we can refer out to our Aboriginal health workers, both from a 715 health assessment but also from a GP management plan. So our Aboriginal health workers receive referrals from our GPs on a regular basis, and they can be used for all sorts of things. They can be done both in the community and also in the clinic. And it's a good way to they can generate MBS income from that as well, but it can range from supporting a patient to access the hospital services, or it could be to monitor their blood pressure or check on compliance with a new medication that's been started. So that's a really important part of the 715 and the care plan, because we know that we need to assist our patients to follow up on the recommendations that have been made by the GPs.
So hang on. I'm hearing you say 715 a lot. I'm not sure if everybody who's listening to us will understand what a 715 is. So can you debrief us on that?
Okay. So 715 is a comprehensive health assessment where we look at the patient's physical, mental, emotional, cultural and spiritual well-being. It's a head-to-toe health assessment, and we usually our doctors, our GPs and our nurses and our AHWs work together on that. So the nurses and the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health workers might collate all the information for the GPs, and then they go in to see the doctor and they do a physical examination as well and just move on from all of that information. And from the 715 health assessment, we can use 5 allied health referrals. So it might be podiatry, exercise physiologist, dietitian, or our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health workers.
And that's actually on top of a GP management plan.
Yes, that is correct. So for an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander person with a chronic disease, they could potentially have up to 10 allied health visits per year. We also get our nurse item numbers that come from a 715 health assessment, so we can do a 10987, which we can do up to 10 times a year. So that's a good way of also generating Medicare income but reaching patient outcomes, because we know that if we see our patients every year for a 715 health assessment, there's going to be certain recommendations that we discuss with the patient and education that we provide, but we need to be checking in with those patients throughout the year, every time they come in and, you know, okay, so how are you going with that? The doctor mentioned that you that he wanted you to see a dietitian and you were happy to see the dietitian, and how'd you go with your appointment? Do you need some help with that? Or, you know, how are you going cutting back on your takeaway or quitting smoking or whatever it might be? So I guess the most important thing to remember from a 715 health assessment is the consent process first. The patient needs to understand what they're getting themselves into. It's not a management health assessment, it's a preventative. So what we're looking at is ways to educate you to make sure that you're not going to end up with a chronic disease, or if you do, what other programs and services do we need to hook you up with so that we can make you a healthier person?
And can I just say, from a doctor's perspective, the 715 is just such a treat, because sometimes we can't see the forest for the trees. There are so many clinical conditions that are going on at once, and sometimes we can get a little bit time poor, a little confused as to where we are in management. And the 715 is an opportunity to step back, see the person as a whole in the context of their life, in the context of their culture and say, what's important to you? What do we need to deal with for you? And what's important to us as clinicians? Get the list, get a plan. And then we've got those five allied health visits that we can start sending people into. Then if they have a chronic disease, they can get the five extra visits with a care plan as well. But I find it such a treat to be able to do a 715 because it makes my job a lot easier. It makes clinical care a lot better.
And they get a cool shirt.
And they get a cool
I've noticed a lot of cool shirts around Toowoomba with the old Carbel snake on it.
And never underestimate the power of a cool shirt.
Exactly. And a cool doctor and a cool Carbel crew. You talked a little bit about the programs that you sort of refer people to. Can you just give me a little rundown of what Carbel can offer? Because I know that out in sort of the non AMS practice that quite often, like as a GP, I'll send patients off to their, I'll do their paperwork for an EPC and then they don't actually attend or something like that. So how do you encourage attendance, compliance for the betterment of all?
So if you're looking at like if they've been diagnosed with diabetes or one of those chronic diseases, so we have a care plan that we have for Carbel Medical Services where our client needs to go along this journey. So if they come from a care plan and they get that referred to the Allied Health, they can get a diabetic cycle of care, things like that, mental health care plans. But then when you look at the other side of things, if we're looking at their social and emotional wellbeing, the holistic care of our client, we have a few programs that we roll out in community. Low-intensity mental health, we have a Strong Fathers, we have a Strong Mothers program, we have TIS, Tackling Indigenous Smoking, CAS, Alcohol and Other Drugs. So we have all these programs that we can help support our client through their health journey with the GP. So whatever the doctor or the GP sees to help with this client, that's where he will refer. And it's usually onto the programs coordinator or person running that program to pick them up. One of the main barriers is to access any programs or the clinic is transport. Carbel's very generous in making sure every program has a car or transport bus or something like that so we can actually go and pick our clients up. So we feed that all the way back to the GPs if they're engaging. So he can say, okay, I referred you to Strong Fathers, how's that going, you know? And all that sort of stuff.
So can you just tell me a little bit of, say, what's the Strong Mothers group? Like what actually happens in that?
Well, it's sort of based off the Strong Fathers program. So women that, you know, their mothers, their carers, their grandmothers, all that sort of aunties, they can come in and do a 8-week program where they're looking at domestic violence, they're looking at what sort of a role model they want to be for their children within their family, within their community, looking at behaviours. You know, we've got to look at what contributes to people's behaviours, how we discipline our kids in the right way with these days. Stress and anger, how, you know, what triggers or what sort of triggers they get when they start feeling angry. So we try and identify their triggers, what make them angry, then give them tools to either, you know, calm them down, walk away or something like that. So it sort of ties in with the Strong Fathers. So if I'm giving the information to dad, well, then the mum's receiving the same information, they can start working a lot better together.
And do you have like a antenatal sort of program or mums and bubs or...?
So, Daniel, it constantly comes back to access. So we know that if we have to refer our clients outside of our organisation, the rate of them not turning up to that referral increases dramatically. So what Carbel has created basically is, as much as we can, a one-stop shop. So we do have in-house antenatal. We have our New Directions Mums and Bubs program. We have child health nurses and midwives involved who do both in-clinic and outreach services within that program. We have over 20 different allied health service providers. We have on-staff psychologists. So the more doctors are able to refer in-house to our services, we know that we can provide the transport. We can understand that there are financial limitations to referring out to specialists that will preclude a lot of our community from accessing them, as because all AMSs are bulk billed for that reason. We know that there's geographic problems, location problems, transport. So the more we can provide, the more chance there is of those necessary referrals from our GPs and nurses actually being taken up by our community. And so that's why CABL has developed as many of those services in-house as is possible. And just recently, together with that, we've also just put in place a fully registered Institute of Aboriginal Health Research, because we work with 7 different universities across Australia to gather the data on different aspects of Aboriginal health so that the main funding bodies, the governments and the federal government, can better target funds to the needs of the gaps that are being identified on the ground by Aboriginal medical services. So we're now actually providing far better and up-to-date research so that that funding can be better targeted.
And just on that note, before we finish there, I think it's great at CABL Medical Services, we all recognise that to provide holistic care, we need to look at the expertise of each person individually within our team. And if we know that, say, you know, Dr. Costelli is looking at our medical side of it, Charlie, we can look at the home and the family life, and we've got, you know, Amy maybe talking about smoking cessation, that it's not just the doctor's role to fix, you know, and help this person become healthy. It's every person's role, and we can all play a part in that. So that gives then Dr. Costelli time to work medically on whatever that looks like. And
it takes a lot of pressure off me.
Yes. Yeah. Which is what doctors are after.
Which is what I'm after.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And beyond that, we have our education programs. So we're not just about dealing with the issues that have occurred. We also commit significant funding to our extensive schools program so that we do a lot of primary and high school age health checks within the schools. We now deliver hearing tests to over 2,000 students a year within our catchment area. We produce quite a number of educational booklets that we provide to the schools for free that are a cultural based a view of how people can better attend to their own health, their physical and mental well-being before these issues arrive. So we're actually trying to address it from both ends of the spectrum, and that's been very successful for us as well.
And say, do your Aboriginal health workers, do they go out into, say, the high schools and stuff like that? So
Well, that is done by Aboriginal health workers. We send out our hearing people when we do the health checks. I'll just let Amy explain what happens at those points.
Tell us what happens, Ames, when you rock up to the high school. Do you turn up with the big...
I'll write it down.
So usually what happens when we go to our schools to do our 715s on the high school kids, we do, you know, males with males, females with females. Well, we try to stick to that to be culturally safe. And just so, you know, younger high school girls, they mightn't be comfortable speaking to a male and vice versa. So we really try to be, you know, culturally aware and make a nice little safe environment to be able to have those conversations. But we're very fortunate enough to have our mob van. So our mob van consists of 2 clinical rooms. One is for the GP and one is for the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health worker. We also have an admin person there who will help, you know, with the eligibility checking and booking and things like that. So the whole 715 is completed at the schools, and they are given their deadly shirt as well, which is usually what makes the kids keep coming back. No, good health. But we're very lucky to be able to get those referrals done straight away at those schools, you know, to have those conversations. And some people mightn't, children feel comfortable coming to the doctors with their mum. They might think their mum might have to go into consultation with them. But so they're able to have those conversations with us, which is, you know, it's good for us to be there for a support as well.
And do you, I'm just interested, with the teenagers, do you talk about the awkward, you know, sexual health stuff and, You know, how do you just throw a whole big bunch of condoms at them and run away? What happens?
Well, yeah, it's a perfect opportunity for us to do a heads assessment. And the registrars listening, they should all know what a heads assessment is. But this is when we talk about the nitty gritty stuff, or as I say, the teenager questions: how your home life is going, how school's going, your relationships, drugs, sex, rock and roll, all of that. But it's a mutually beneficial arrangement, us going to the schools, because we have this non-threatening environment where we can ask those questions and get probably a more reliable answer than when we're in the clinic and mum's in the waiting room. Because even though we send mum out, we know that mums have got eyes in the back of their heads and they've got
those extendable ears, like in the Harry Potter show, where they're like, it goes under the door. Absolutely. What's happening in there? They question the kid when they come out. What'd you say to the doctor?
Yes. And as much as we say, no one can hear and I'm not going to tell mum anything, if she's there, the answers might be different. So when we go to the schools, it's on their turf. It's non-threatening. We have music playing. We're having fun. It's fun for them. And I think I get a better story from these kids. And I'm always surprised at how many of them come back to the clinic when I've put a recommendation in that 715 and said, I need to see you to talk more about this. And usually it's something like a mental health care plan or something that really requires us to dig in and spend some time with them. But they always come.
Also, I think I'd like to add on to that, Danielle, is that I think with the Closing the Gap initiative, if we want to close or start trying to close the life expectancy of Indigenous to non-Indigenous, we got to start somewhere, and I think we got to start with our children. So if we're offering this service to our children, I think it's amazing, and I think we'll start seeing that we're going to close the gap with that life expectancy in generations to come.
We do get criticised from time to time because we do provide the incentives, the shirts and the footballs and the things you've talked about.
They're good footballs. Yeah, I saw them yesterday.
Cracker footballs. But our mantra is whatever it takes. You know, it's no good. You can have the best services in the world, you know, the most up-to-date, top-quality health services, but if no one accesses it, then, you know, I've never seen an award yet for the best medical service that ever closed. So whatever it takes to get our community in the door and access those services, that's what we do. And I know there are people out there saying, well, that's all well and good if you get all this funding of taxpayers' money. But I just want to clarify that AMS is only partially subsidised for what they do. So in Carbal's case, we self-generate over 40% of our own funding. So much of what we do, the schools program completely, is 100% funded by Carbal. So we don't get access to all of the government money that people think that is available. We just bulk bill and we make the same amount of money from doing that as a normal bulk billing practice would do. And we use those funds, because we're a not-for-profit, to fill the gaps and generate programs that will address the needs that we know that we've identified. So it's not this big bucket of money that flows to AMSs. In fact, AMSs get only 3% of the overall health budget, but Aboriginal people make up 6% of the population. So if we did it on a figures-only basis, AMSs are grossly underfunded for the numbers of people that they're servicing. So I just wanted to dispel that myth, because I hear it almost every day in my role.
And just off that note of the schools, whilst we do go through a rigorous consent process, part of that is that the parents are consenting to follow up allied Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health worker visits to the school. So once the 715 is completed and the doctor refers out to our lovely Amy, we can go back to the school throughout the rest of the terms and the school year and provide education on, you know, smoking, sexual health, whatever it might be, drugs and alcohol. But it also is implementing a norm for those students that a preventative health check is what we're going to do. We've done it every year of our school life, and when we leave school, we're going to continue to come back to our GPs. We've made a relationship and we know that this is what we need to do. So it's normalising it for our patients, our students as well.
It's setting up community. Some very good health literacy.
Yeah, definitely.
And a byproduct of that, we've been contacted just this year by two high school girls after one of our visits who rang to find out what they would have to do to become an Aboriginal health worker. So it's just a great ad for getting more Aboriginal people involved in the health sector. I'm not sure if it was you, Ames, but we'll give you the credit.
It was a compliment.
Yes.
Yeah, so, you know, the more people we can get involved, the better, and that's been a real positive byproduct to those school visits.
So it sounds like Carbal is doing some amazing work in the community, and I'm sure that you make big changes in people's lives. Have you got a standout patient or something that has, you know, that, you know, made your heart, you know, quite often in GP land or with doctors, we have what we call the heart sink patients who just make us feel really depressed after they leave because it's like, oh, my God, I just really want to change this person's life and how do I do it? Have you had someone that you just did like a little air punch, like, yeah, like you're at the end of some like 80s, you know, movie and you're like, yes, that was so good?
I'm laughing here because several years ago you asked me this exact same question.
What?
Yes.
Hey, I change it around. I change it up.
No, but back then I said to you that everybody was outstanding. You know, I was a registrar. I was naive.
You were young and naive.
And all of that.
So now you're more jaded. What's your...
Yeah, well, I was going to say I'm all sage and wise. No, oh. I'm not. But I do have someone, and I think everybody here knows this person without too much information.
Sure.
There were some mental health issues that were pretty significant. And as often does come along with that, there was some alcohol issues as well. This person stopped drinking alcohol and improved their health out of sight. And this is not an easy thing to do for someone with serious mental health issues. And I don't think any of us ever said it, but none of us thought that this would happen. But this person, the pride that this person felt having done this on their own, I think was infectious. We all know who we're talking about. Yeah, because we all know who we're talking about because this person affected us all. And I think that's one outstanding patient, but that's one of many.
It's just the only way I could get.
So that was five fist pumps.
Yeah.
Just make that clear, you weren't talking about the
CEO. I'd hope not.
I was not talking about the CEO.
Disclaimer. I also had one of those experiences not long ago. I had a client who came in and unfortunately their brother passed away last year, due to medical complications. He went to the doctor and then a week later passed. So this specific client was very scared on coming into the clinic because he had, you know, some issues going on. Once he came in, we had a bit of a chat, you know, spoke about lifestyle, choices, family, mental health, had that conversation in our new patient screening, which we're, you know, given 20 minutes with the patient. After all of this, the first visit he came, we found out that there was something that, you know, a chronic disease that this patient had. But we were fortunate enough to have that time into that conversation. And now that patient is, you know, fit, healthy, going to the gym, coming back saying, you know, I'm pretty much living here, but in a positive way, and is a part of our programs and has really just absorbed the Carbal community for what it is. And he, you know, when he comes in, that conversation will always stick with me and that consultation with that client. So making a difference to one person, making a difference to a whole community. That's why we do what we do.
You give me goosebumps.
Oh, a little heart. So I just want to sort of ask a question back of our lovely doctor. So I have noticed that you are a non-Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander person.
It's true. I'm a white fella.
White fella. So what's a white fella like you doing in a place like Carbal?
That is an interesting question. I contacted Carbal towards the beginning of the end of my second year in general practice. It had been growing for a little while, but I find that in Australia, and I don't know if this is going to be controversial, but let it be so, white people are very protected away from anything to do with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And I had a conversation with a friend and I said, you know, my experience of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people is what I see on television. And that didn't sit very well with me because I have a deep mistrust for Australian media anyway. The CEO is looking at me like I'm a conspiracy freak.
No, Brian, don't check computer, check work computer, make sure.
Looking at the cost of the lawsuits. That'll come in.
But what it boils down to is I thought, well, I need to work in this community and be around people from a different cultural background to try and get a better understanding, because it's never going to happen through a television screen. It's never going to happen from social media. And I've been working in an AMS for twice as long as I ever worked in a non-AMS.
Why?
Because I love it. It's
why?
It's a, don't have any other
I'm not as eloquent as Asi. Yeah. I love it because it's so much more fulfilling to me in my experience. And look, it was a limited experience anyway in a non-AMS. But I do feel like I get the skills that we learn in medical school, I can apply them here like I can anywhere else. Culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds, this is something that medical schools focus on these days. I'll be delicate when I say these days.
Old man?
Pause for elderly joke. But I think what is really interesting is that the presentations, it's a little skewed. Registrars may not remember the beach data, but any working GP will remember and lament the death of beach data. But that would help us to figure out what was going to present at what stage of the life and where. But that's all different within the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. We see 30-year-old people on dialysis, which I'd never seen previously. So it's the diversity of the presentations and it's the slight skew that keeps things a little interesting and spicy for me still after 4 years.
Jalapeno margaritas keep it spicy for me.
Mm.
She says she's come back from LA.
That sounds good.
Yeah. No, not that we're advocating that. But so for other GP registrars, why would they want to come and, say, work with Carbel?
It's really fulfilling in what you can put in place for people. You are one part of the team as a doctor, but in general practice, it's so easy to see yourself as the centre of the universe because it's you and your client and four walls. But outside of those four walls, you can have a big team like we have at Carbel. We're like one big happy family.
Yes, we are.
Is that corny?
Sing it, sister.
Is that
we're
corny
a family.
Enough? Is that corny enough for everyone?
That was perfect. I'll pay you later.
But I think that's true. Like, I think a lot of my registrars who've worked in Aboriginal and, you know, medical services, that they really do become part of the community, whereas before they might have been outside of the community. And then being in the AMS, they become enmeshed in it and, you know, the aunties will come and want to know what's happening in your life, like, you know, so you become included. And so that is how you become family. I don't think it's corny at all. I think becoming family with your team is something that can happen in a GP practice if it's working well, but being enmeshed in the community I think is something that is, you know, you can't, you know, it's priceless if we're going to talk about the, what's that, MasterCard ad or something like that. It is. That sort of stuff makes your heart feel good. So now I have a question that I think that might be interesting for not just GPs but for other doctors who are listening, is that how do we build a relationship with the AMS? So, for instance, if I'm a hospital-based doctor and I've got an Aboriginal patient who's discharging and they mightn't have a regular GP, what am I going to do? Like, how do I just flick it off to the social worker and fingers crossed hope for the best? Can we just ring your mob up or?
Yeah, Danielle, look, we outside the health service, we do a lot of community engagement sort of stuff too. So we try and get Carwell out to as many places as possible, let them know about our programs. Within our programs itself, it goes to non-Indigenous medical centres anyway, you know, to disperse some of their education about ITC, which is integrated team care or tackling Indigenous smoking. So when I go out, I also engage with the Indigenous liaison officers, especially at the hospitals. So they can make contact either through myself or they can make contact through the clinic. And we're there to help our mob. So any GPs out there that are not working at an AMS and they deal with Indigenous clients, be like Dr. Adrian Castelli and don't be the main sole provider. Look outside that square and hook up with us because we're only happy to help.
So GPs who work in non-AMSs, are they able to refer to your programs, for instance, your strong fathers, strong mothers?
Yeah, definitely, yep. I actually gave our allied health manager or reception lady a referral from a Millmerran clinic because he's Indigenous. He wants to come through and get his mental health cared for by Indigenous. So they sent through a referral plus his mental health care plan, and she's organised an appointment for him. With the programs, especially strong fathers, they don't have to be a CABL client. We don't try and poach clients when they come and do the program either. If they are interested in what actually CABL does, we'll tell them. It's their own choice if they want to come and access the other stuff. But as soon as the strong fathers program or any other program that they get referred to is finished, they go back to their normal GP. Yeah.
And I guess it's just really important wherever you are to, you know, go through your local primary health network and find out what services are available in your area, because I'm sure that like every AMS, like us, we're all there for the same reason. We're there for mob. We want to help make the lives of our community better. So if you, you know, do your research, find out who your local Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander liaison officer is at the hospital, contact your primary health network, find out what other services are available there for you to tap into, because, you know, if there's services available, we need to be using them.
And if you're a GPTQ registrar, I'm a cultural mentor for these guys too, so you can give us a call, CABL, and ask for myself, and I can help you out that way also.
And one of the things Charlie has touched on, I guess the barrier, all of the programs that we run, and I think we run 23 programs outside of our clinical services, can all be accessed by referral or contact from any GP in any clinic. One of the barriers, I guess, is that some clinics will think that if they refer clients into that, the likelihood is they will then switch across and attend our clinic and not theirs. That doesn't happen. We make no attempt to poach clients. Really needs to come back to, are you doing the best you can for that client that you're trying to service? And if they're an Aboriginal person and they need culturally safe and aware programs and you're not tapping into your AMS, I'm not sure that you aren't doing that client a disservice. So I'm hoping we can get beyond that. I mean, it's business these days, but that is a barrier for us, that we don't get referrals that we should get because they're worried that they will lose them as a client. And in reality, it rarely happens. They stay on as clients. In fact, they appreciate that that clinic has risen above the dollar value to say, well, these are programs you can tap into by the local AMS that we can refer you into, and still continue to liaise with our AHWs and our other staff about the outcomes of those programs. We're happy to liaise and give feedback at any time for clients that are referred into those programs.
So tell me, this is our, we'll have to say goodbye after this little question, but how can a GP registrar, if they're keen to come and work at CABL, what are they going to do?
So if you are keen to come and work with our amazing team.
CABL keen.
If you're CABL keen.
Hashtag
copyright. CABL keen. If all you need to do is look us up on the website, so CABL Medical Services, and get in contact with either myself, Tamika Campbell, Clinic Manager, or Kim Pasanti, our Clinics and Quality Manager, and we can point you in the right direction and have a chat with you. We would love to hear from you.
Yeah.
Woo!
So thank you so much, CABL, for your time and generosity. It's been an excellent podcast. I've enjoyed myself very much. I feel like I'm part of the CABL crew.
You are.
Thank you.
And
yes.
We've got a cool shirt for you.
Oh, thank you. It's what I've always wanted. I want a football. No, I'm very uncoordinated. So thank you so much, team, and all the best in the future, and keep doing the great work you're doing.
And just on behalf of everybody here, we'd like to thank you for having us and to, you know, getting our voice out there as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Please subscribe and check out our YouTube channel, Indigenous Health Med Talk. This podcast is a General Practice Training Queensland initiative supported by Australian General Practice Training and the Australian Government.